but also the leadership of the insurgents left and went to nearby Ramadi. So the Marines had to clear the city, and the people left were kind of insurgent foot soldiers who were just going to try to kill as many Marines and soldiers as they could before they died. They were sort of hopped up on amphetamines, and it was an extremely tough battle, and they used what civilians were left as shields. So it was an awful meat grinding battle. And then in the middle of it, between the two, the military was focused on the south, on Shiite insurgents led by Muqtada al-Sadr, who had sort of taken over one of the holiest cities in Shia Islam, Najaf. And it was a similarly complex battle. They had to deal with these insurgents, but not hurt them. Eventually, they sheltered in the Imam Ali Shrine, the main mosque, which Marines couldn't bomb. It was a really holy site, and they had to deal with that. And then it too had a political end. So these were, at some level, frustrating battles. I mean, in this sense, you do see the politics, from the point of view of the people on the ground, how it affects, they got to do this, they got to do that, how the changing winds of politics affects the goals of the battle. So that's the overview of the two battles.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK Quad Cities NPR.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson. We've got a couple of important days coming up here this week. One is, of course, everybody knows about is Veterans Day on Tuesday, November 11th. The other one, I imagine, not as many people know about, and that's Monday. November 10th is the 250th anniversary of the United States Marine Corps. And really, in an example of great timing, there's a new documentary out that I've had the privilege of watching that's going to be airing Monday night on PBS at 9 o'clock Central, 10 o'clock Eastern. Again, I got a chance to preview it, and it's so good. Let me tell you about it a little bit. And I'm very lucky to have the producer of this documentary with me as my guest today. It's a privilege. His name is Michael Pack, and the name of this documentary is The Last 600 Meters. It's about the Iraq War and our troops, the Marines in Iraq, and two of the toughest battles they faced. I want him to tell you about this, and so I'm going to just introduce him now and thank him, Michael, for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
And thank you for doing this. It's very powerful. I can't recommend it enough, but let me just back up. You're an award-winning film producer and documentarian. I've seen some of your work. What led you to this topic? And I guess we're about 20 years on from these battles in 2004. What led you to look at this, and why come up with this now?
Well, the film has been many years in the making. We began while the Iraq War was still going on, and I was doing research on a documentary on the Iraq War. Originally, the focus was going to be on technology and warfare, but the more research I did, the more I saw that a lot of the battles really depended on just really the grit and determination of the people on the ground. And these two battles, which, as you say, are the biggest battles in Iraq, and actually the biggest battles America has fought since Vietnam. They're mainly, but not exclusively, Marine battles. So it is nice that it's going to be broadcast on the 250th anniversary of the Marine Corps. Although I don't want to neglect the Army and Special Forces, and we have one Air Force Special Forces woman in the film. So I was working on it for a long time. We shot the interviews in 2007. So the people were still the age they are in the footage. Their memories were still fresh. So then we completed a version shortly thereafter. And we went back and forth with PBS for many years. And I think really the process was clouded by people's political feelings about the war. Even though the film does not take any position on the war whatsoever, and has been liked and admired by people on all sides of that particular question. As you know, it's called The Last 600 Meters because a sniper says in the film, "I don't make foreign policy, I deliver the last 600 meters of it," meaning what he could see through a sniper scope. And we tried to stay true to that, to be that last bit, the ground truth, the people fighting the battles. And so for that reason, even though the film was most of the film was pretty much made a bunch of 17 years ago, I think it's still current because we captured the moment. And it's my hope that it'll be current 10 years from now when people look back at these battles, as I am sure they will. It'll give them some understanding and hear from people shortly after the time frame. So that's why I picked it, and I have been working on it a long time. It's extremely gratifying to me that PBS has put it on the Marine Corps birthday and the day before Veterans Day, and then it'll be streaming on Amazon starting on the 11th, and I think other services as well.
Right. It's so powerful. And you bring up a great point, and I want to emphasize this to our listeners. This is a political show. I have people from both sides of the aisle on this show. And this is not political. I went into this wondering, but you did a masterful job of avoiding any mention of politics, which is great because everything now is political and you get so tired of it. This is not. This is a focus on our troops. These heroes who were over there fighting on our behalf. And I want to emphasize this. And this is what makes it so good to me. You put them front and center in their actions. So I just want to emphasize that to our listeners.
Yeah, we the way we made the film really is we have them speaking directly to camera, talking about what they did in battle, not any of their opinions. And the other thing we did in making the film is we began with the footage that we thought was the most dramatic in both in these battles, First Battle of Fallujah, Najaf, Second Battle of Fallujah. So we got the footage first, and then we look for the people in the footage. So they're always talking about themselves in the footage rather than making abstract points. So the film intends to be a story. I have lots of my own opinions, as you do, but this film isn't really about that.
Right. Talk about the two battles, if you would. I know most people have heard a little bit of Fallujah. I read Bing West's book on it, actually, who's Bing West is in the documentary. But give our listeners a little bit of background on both of these battles, these cities, where they're at, their populations, why they were strategically important.
I will, but since you mentioned Bing West, I have to say, we who make documentaries really rely heavily on people who've done much more extensive research and written books. And Bing West's book on Fallujah, I think, is the definitive book. But we have other military experts in the film, although not much. We mainly tell the story from the people who fought there. But the film relies on their research, as well as relying, as I say, on the footage taken by very heroic combat cameramen and photographers, commercial photographers. Anyway, the film the these the film begins with the First Battle of Fallujah, and some of your listeners may remember, if they're old enough, that it began when four Blackwater contractors were murdered, burned. Two of them, I think, were dragged through the streets of Fallujah, and two were hung from a bridge. Their charred bodies hung from a bridge. People chanted under the bridge, celebrating and kind of pounding on the bodies, including children. And that so shocked the nation that the decision was to sort of take over the city of Fallujah and drive the insurgents out. And so that initiated the first battle. And this was in the north. Fallujah is in the so-called Sunni Triangle. And these were Sunni insurgents. And they were really the heart of the problem for the Americans there. So that was the First Battle of Fallujah, and it ended when, because well, the Marines went in, they started to clear the city, and right away, world opinion was, oh, they're hurting civilians, because the insurgents in both these battles use the techniques that insurgents often use, and you see today in, say, Hamas, where they shelter behind civilians, they're in hospitals. They try to force Americans to do things that look excessive, and they did. And the footage went all over the world. And because of that, the Iraqi government pressured the U.S. government to halt the First Battle of Fallujah, and after negotiations, to pull out entirely and leave it to the Fallujah Brigade to run. And the Fallujah Brigade was essentially the insurgents all over again. So they had Fallujah, the city, as a safe haven for months. And they used it as an arms depot and a place for traveling insurgents to stop over, and also became a series of torture chambers, and beheadings occurred there. And we show that too. And those atrocities forced the Marines to go in a second time and take it over. And just as an overview of that second battle, so because they didn't want to look bad like they did the first time, they announced that they, when they were coming in, and they asked all civilians to leave, and something like 80-90% of the civilians left, still plenty of civilians in a big city. But also the leadership of the insurgents left and went to nearby Ramadi. So the Marines had to clear the city, and the people left were kind of insurgent foot soldiers who were just going to try to kill as many Marines and soldiers as they could before they died. They were sort of hopped up on amphetamines. And it was an extremely tough battle, and they used what civilians were left as shields. So it was an awful meat-grinding battle. And then in the middle of it, between the two, the military was focused on the south, on Shiite insurgents led by Muqtada al-Sadr, who had sort of taken over this one of the holiest cities in Shia Islam, Najaf. And it was a similarly complex battle. They had to deal with these insurgents, but not hurt them. Eventually, they sheltered in the Imam Ali Shrine, the main mosque, which they couldn't, Marines couldn't bomb. It was a really holy site, and they had to deal with that. And then it too had a political end. So these were at some level frustrating battles. I mean, you, in this sense, you do see the politics, how it kind of, it, how it, from the point of view of the people on the ground, how it affects, they got to do this, they got to do that, how the changing winds of politics affects the goals of the battle. So that's the overview of the two battles.
Yeah, you also mentioned Al Jazeera, the media source in the Middle East, that and I remember this when it happened. They were used for propaganda purposes. There's no other way of putting it. I mean, I think most people, regardless of politics, would agree to that, that a message was getting out there on critical of our troops when and trying to do their jobs. That was, I think, incorrect and over dramatized. That didn't help our cause much there.
Absolutely. There's a scene in the second Battle of Fallujah where they're clearing a hospital, which had been a focus of controversy in the first battle too. The Marines are clearing this hospital, and they're trying to find the insurgents and sort out the patients. And while they're there, while they're actually still clearing the battle, you can see, and it's amazing to see it on the monitor in the hospital, Algiers coverage of that very event with their spin, their negative spin on it, before the Marines have even left the hospital. They kind of took it off the satellite. I think it was ABC or NBC footage that was going over, and they were able to take it and put their own spin on it. I mean, incredible. And meanwhile, the army and the DOD generally tends to get this footage out days and days later. You know, don't release it to our media, so everything is then delayed, and they're ahead of the curve, and they've already shaped public opinion. And I think you do see that today. It's the same as what Hamas is able to do in Gaza. They get their images out fast and first in a lot of cases. And then by the time the record is corrected, it's already entered the public debate. And I mean, I think it's a brilliant tactic on the part of insurgents. They will use it again.
It makes you wonder, and this may be off a little off topic, it just makes you wonder how we would have handled that in World War II and other battles before the onset of the media and the changing tactics that have been used that put our troops at a disadvantage. I think that's a fair statement.
Yeah, I think it absolutely does. It's a much more complex, much more political environment. In fact, we showed the film to we had gotten a small grant to take it to military bases, and we showed it at Quantico to these recon Marines. That's sort of the Marine Special Forces unit from World War II, who had been, you know, the island hopping Marines, right? They would go to places like Iwo Jima ahead of the other Marines, right? So these people, really heroic. I mean, their lives were on the line. And they all said, after watching the film, that they could not do what these young Marines were doing. As they said, it was simple for them. They got on an island. If they saw anyone Japanese, they killed them. And if a Japanese person saw anyone American, they killed them. I mean, that was it. They didn't have to think about it all the time. They didn't have to deal with press coverage. They didn't have any of these other factors. These young Marines have to think about how it's going to look in international media. They have to see when they see someone, they have to decide whether it's a civilian they help or someone who's sheltering an insurgent or has a suicide vest on who's going to kill them. And often it's the very young Marines that are making these decisions. The young people, you can see them in the film, that are in some cases just out of high school, late teens, early 20s. I mean, I myself, I can't imagine what I would have done at that age. And it's a lot to ask of these young people. And I think they largely rose to that occasion.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm very delighted to have today as my guest Michael Pack, who's the president of Manifold Productions. He's an award-winning filmmaker and documentarian. He's just produced just an outstanding documentary that's going to air here in a couple nights, Monday night, on PBS at 9 o'clock Central. It's called The Last 600 Meters. And it's about two of the deadliest battles in the Iraq War here that took place in 2004. I still have memories of them, and he's just done an outstanding job of displaying these through the words of those who participated in it, our troops. And that's what makes it so powerful. I saw many names that I knew. A young Seth Moulton, who Democratic congressman from Massachusetts, as I mentioned, Bing West in there. So there's some people in here that I think are some of our listeners may be familiar with. I kept thinking, and correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, but Fallujah was urban warfare, house-to-house combat. And the previous time we did that was in Hue in Vietnam, I believe. And I read a book on that, and then I read Bing West's book on Fallujah. And you try to imagine that, and the troops say they were waiting on us there. The insurgents were prepared. It's chilling to think about that, what they went into to clear that town, and that comes across in this documentary very well.
Well, thank you. Well, to correct something, I it's supposed to be broadcast at 10 p.m. at the same time across the country, but it is
Oh,
true
okay.
that it's best to check because PBS stations tend to adjust. Some have actually put it on at 9 p.m., but some bumped it to 11. So wherever your listeners are, they should double check. And then, of course, if they miss it, they can see it on Amazon the next day
Okay.
and
Thank you for
thereafter.
correcting me.
But I think you're right. I mean, the Way City comparison was in everybody's mind. At one of these screenings, General Christmas, who was one of the heroes of Way City, saw it, and of course, it was in his mind. It was a lot like Way City, and I believe, we always say we're never going to fight this kind of war again. We're only going to do the clear war where it all makes sense and there is none of this ambiguity. But you can't do that all the time. I mean, in the history of warfare, most wars have been this kind of lower level counterinsurgency warfare, not the massive wars of World War I and World War II. I mean, the next war might be, I hope, I pray it isn't, a massive war with China, but it's more likely that it'll be proxy wars like we fought with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And a lot of those are these small scale wars that, as you say, involve a lot of urban warfare of a type where you have to pay attention to the hearts and minds of the population. So yeah, it is like Way City. In fact, the film ends with because this it has this surrealistic aspect that you get with these kind of battles at the end. And at the end, they're thinking about Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket, which also ends at Way City, where they wander through this hellscape and sing the Mickey Mouse song. And so did the troops at the Second Battle of Fallujah, who love Full Metal Jacket. I'm not my favorite Kubrick film, but they love it. And they sing that song too. And it's got that same surrealistic quality. I mean, after you've gone through these meat grinder, horrible wars, you're in this very weird psychological space. And you're in some sort of zone. You have this, for you forge this huge bond with the people near you. And then that is sort of in some ways emotionally satisfying, and then you've lost some of your best friends and buddies, and you've killed people. So it's all a kind of weird, a horrible psychological mix. And the city is nearly destroyed, just like Wave City. You know, houses are still burning, things are going on. So yes, it's like Wave City. You are right to make that analogy, Robin. I think it was in everyone's mind that was there.
And through battle and the horror of battle and these stories that are told, the tragedy, the heroism, there's these little stories that come out of it that are funny, odd, strange. I'm not sure how, but it was kind of a welcome break when the troops were describing going into Sodder's home and finding. Well, I'll let you say it. It's
It's hard to believe, really. You know, so in between, in the middle of a battle of Najaf, the special forces are going after high value targets relating to Najaf and others. And in Najaf, they break into Sadr's home. Sadr isn't there. He's the leader of the Mahdi army and the Mahdi militia. And, you know, a fierce enemy of America and everything American, and a hater of everything American stands for, apparently. But in they break into get into his bedroom, and there are framed pictures of what you remember. This is 2004, of American action heroes of that era, Sylvester Stallone and Bruce Willis or whoever it was. He has framed portraits of American action heroes, you know, just what you wouldn't expect. It is, I think they were all kind of amused at that, you know, if you hate America, why these framed portraits. I consider myself a lover of American movies. I have no framed portraits in my home of actors either, in fact.
I don't either. Well, I'll leave it to psychiatrists to explain that, why he would have that up. But it's kind of an interesting tidbit from this film. The documentary kind of ends a little bit on a just a tragic but heroic note with what's described as the Hell House. I'll let you talk a little bit about that and what it was and what they saw and what they faced there, our
Well,
troops.
I always feel in describing these things that, and I'm sure you'll agree, that I don't do justice to it at all, because hearing from me is like the opposite of hearing from the people who fought there. But I'll give your audience a taste, and hopefully that'll encourage them to tune into the real thing. So they're clearing that house by house, block by block, Fallujah in the second battle, and towards the end they get into this. They're clearing this one house, later called Hell House, where a group of Marines are pinned by gunfire from a second story. And that's really the worst case, where you have gunfire from above and there's crossfire from two sides. So Marines are pinned. Other Marines go to try to rescue them. They get pinned. And it just sucks more and more Marines in. Finally, this group goes in with Jesse Grapes, who's in the film, a very courageous th then lieutenant. And in order to go in, they have to climb through these windows with bars on them. They have to take their Kevlar off. So they go in unarmed into this kill zone to rescue these Marines. And his team and he cross the kill zone four times to pull the Marines out. And they succeed in getting all the Marines out. I mean, obviously, many of them are wounded, but they get them out after hours and hours of fighting. And then, you know, they finally, then they can, tankers can level the house. But it was a horrible fight. And you can see, even, I'm always reminded of the images after. You can see, as the Marines, you know, drink water and recover, their faces, what the experience was like, you know, marked on their faces. They're stunned and shocked faces. And it really is an amazing moment. I mean, it's very heroic, but as you say, you know, a horrible thing has happened.
We've got 2 or 3 minutes left here. I guess I've tried to touch on some key moments that I saw in it to have you talk about a little bit. But again, our discussion for our listeners in no way touches the impact of the images and what these troops say on, and so I can't urge folks strongly enough to tune in if they can or see it on Amazon, as Michael said. But As a documentarian, I'm curious. This is your profession. You've done this a lot. Was there anything as you were putting this together and taping these individuals or talking to these individuals that you took away from that? Any specific memory or something that surprised you?
Well, making documentaries, and you say I've been doing it a long time. I've done over 15 that have been broadcast on PBS, and your listeners can go, excuse me, can go to our website, manifoldproductions.com, to learn about the others. Or we have a new company, Palladium Pictures. You can go to palladiumpictures.com for the newer ones. And you learn from everything. I mean, it's a privilege to be have been allowed to tell these people's stories. And each film really changes you and changes you a lot. This film especially, I was really moved by these stories myself and the heroism of these people. And yeah, I think it's something I will never forget. We had a screening in Washington where some of them came now, 17 years after I met them, and it was really amazing to see them. And I was reminded when I met them again of what it was like to see them the first time. And I have three sons who are now around 30, and then were like little boy, high school and middle school kids. And they met a couple of them when they came to our house for dinner before an interview, and it changed their lives forever. I mean, it changed their view of everything. And for my sons, seeing them again, they were so happy they could go out and drink beers with them now that they're not little boys anymore. But yeah, it changed me, and it changed my view of war, and it changed my view of the military. And it was a profoundly moving experience for me. And I hope to convey that in the film, but it was deeply moving for me and my family.
I think you did. I can say that. I'm 100% certain that you did a great job of conveying that. It's a remarkable, remarkable film, documentary, and I again, as Michael said, our listeners should check the PBS listings because it's on at either 10 o'clock Monday night or 9 o'clock here in the Central Time Zone. But check it out. Again, it's called The Last 600 Meters. The timing is excellent coming the night before Veterans Day, but also the day of the 250th anniversary of our Marine Corps. You'll see some heroic young Americans talking about their experiences there. And just as a son of a man, my dad served in World War II and the Korean War and talked about his experiences. And that's what I kept thinking about, all the people that have served our country and those that have made the ultimate sacrifice for our freedoms. So I salute you and congratulate you for this very important piece of work, Michael.
Thank you very much, Robin. Thank you for
Thank
that.
you. Thank you for being a guest.
Yeah, you're quite welcome. It was my pleasure.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.